This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/radio3.
The medieval Middle East is the stuff of fantasy, from the windswept deserts of Arabia to the bustling bazaars of cities like Baghdad and Cairo. But what were these places actually like? And what part did they play in creating great men, and sometimes women, of letters, science and art? Cities figured in the Muslim imagination as hubs of religion, government, commerce and culture. Medieval Muslim geographers often conceptualized their world as one of routes, linking an endless series of towns and cities like stars glittering in the firmament. Although some of these cities, like Jerusalem and Damascus, were already ancient when the Muslims arrived in the 7th century, others, Baghdad and Cairo included, were new Muslim creations, brash, vibrant and dense with talent, the New Yorks of their age. The most famous city of all in the classical Islamic world was Baghdad, home of Harun al-Rashid and the setting for the Thousand and One Nights. It was founded by the Abbasid Caliph al-Mansur in the 750s to celebrate his accession to power and to give the Abbasid dynasty a fine new capital to house their court, their government offices, and the army which had brought them to power. Called Madinat as-Salam, the City of Peace, it was a new build with an unusual round plan. The Caliph's palace and the great mosque stood at the centre of a vast, rather empty plaza, surrounded by two concentric rings of buildings, divided into quadrants by axial routes, which led out of the city via huge gateways. The plan was probably inspired by past Persian round cities. The city was also close to the ruins of Ctesiphon, previously the capital of the Sasanian Persian Empire, which the Muslim Arabs had ousted a century before. These were bold signs that the Muslims were there to stay, but also that they respected the heritage of their Persian predecessors, and indeed were inspired by it. But the site of Baghdad only worked because it had all sorts of practical advantages, listed by an advisor to al-Mansur, whom the historian At-Tabari cites as saying, "Supplies would come to you up the Tigris in ships from China, India and Basra. Stores would reach you from Armenia and those adjacent areas via the Tamara Canal connected to the Zab River, as well as from Byzantium. You would be among waterways where no enemy of yours could reach you, except by a floating or fixed bridge. The proper organisation of cities requires you to make walls, moats and forts, but the Tigris and the Euphrates shall be the moats of the commander of the faithful." This prime location meant that Baghdad quickly became the first Islamic metropolis, spilling out from the round city built by al-Mansur into a series of large suburbs where the mosques, markets and public amenities of Baghdad were to be found. Even the Abbasid caliphs themselves preferred to escape the confines of the round city, and princes and princesses soon built new palaces alongside the Tigris, with terraces and gardens where they could take the air and admire the view. Baghdad was a magnet for adventurous and talented people of all religions and ethnicities, Arabs from Kufa and Basra to the south, Persians and Turks from the lands to the east, and even some Berbers from North Africa. Some came for a visit, but many stayed and made their home in Baghdad. Some came voluntarily, and others, Turks and Africans especially, came as slaves. All contributed to the economic and cultural flowering of the city. At the heart of life in Baghdad was the court of the caliph. The Abbasid court, like many other medieval courts, was a theatrical place in which the power, prestige and mystique of Islamic monarchy were demonstrated by strict protocols and displays of fabulous wealth in the form of precious automata, like the famous tree of gold and silver in a fountain, ornamented with mechanical birds that sang, that intrigued visitors passing through the courtyard in which it stood. But as well as seeking to impress with luxurious gimmicks, the Abbasids also enhanced their reputation in ways of more value to their own society and many to follow. They invested heavily in knowledge production, what we might today call research and the arts. There was a Persian twist to this as well. The Persian emperors of the past had believed that all knowledge had disseminated from Iran, and that it was part of an emperor's job to bring that knowledge home. Persian converts to Islam encouraged the Abbasids to think in the same way, and this dovetailed very neatly with the saying of the Prophet Muhammad, "Seek knowledge, even to China." The result was the translation movement, a feverish century starting around 760, during which cohorts of Baghdad-based translators and scholars rendered a vast amount of Greek knowledge into Arabic, as well as some Persian and Sanskrit materials, and then interrogated and built on what they had translated. Philosophy, mathematics, astronomy, and medicine all flourished as a result, alongside sophisticated theological approaches to the still young religion of Islam, which helped Muslims to compete with the highly developed theology and philosophy of their Christian subjects. Scholars disagree about the personal role of the Abbasid caliphs in this process, but certainly the court and the Baghdad elite as a whole showed deep commitment to paying for translations and promoting scholarship. Perhaps they did this to advance their own careers in the civil service. Perhaps, as a nouveau riche group, they wanted to be seen as purveyors of the emerging Arabic high culture. Or perhaps they believed that the Abbasids should adopt Persian ways. Whatever their reasons, their choices had long-lasting consequences for Islamic civilization and, in the long term, the path taken by the European Renaissance. The physical environment in Baghdad played an important part in the spread of learning. The caliph's mysterious Bayt al-Hikmah, House of Knowledge, may have been a royal archive, a library, or a research centre. We don't really know. But many Abbasid courtiers established their own libraries and translation centres and paid lavish salaries to the translators and scholars working within them. The Banu Musa brothers, wards of the Caliph al-Ma'mun, were just such courtiers. They sent missions to Byzantium for books and discovered the great mathematician Thabit ibn Qurra, in addition to founding a library. The introduction and spread of paper meant that these libraries could be stocked much more easily than in the era of parchment and papyrus, and more people had access to written information. Some of these libraries were private, open to the friends and colleagues of their owners, but others were more public and open to those scholars and educated men who sought out the knowledge within them. Some even provided paper for note-taking. Descriptions of libraries in the texts that we have mention multiple rooms, ornate bookshelves, catalogues, and staff to assist the readers. Book borrowing and copying was also common. New ideas were tested in a quintessential Baghdad institution, the Majlis, a gathering of men for more or less serious entertainment and discussion, something like a literary salon. The great ideas of the day in philosophy, theology, and science were aired and fine-tuned in such settings, and many an aspiring intellectual found employment after a good performance in a majlis. Learning wasn't, of course, limited to such gatherings. It permeated the atmosphere of Baghdad. Legal specialists taught in the great mosques. Philosophers and literati welcomed students to their homes. Practitioners of medicine instructed young doctors in another new institution, the hospital, several of which were founded in Baghdad by wealthy benefactors, including the caliphs themselves, to offer treatment to those too poor to pay for a doctor to come to them. The lead taken by the rich and powerful of Baghdad was followed by the elites of provincial cities, which also gained libraries and hospitals as a result. This combination of wealth, opportunity, and sustained interest in learning made Baghdad a unique place. But as the power of the Abbasids waned, other centres began to emerge as rival capitals of learning. The most successful was Cairo, capital of the Fatimid caliphs from 972 to 1171. During these centuries, Baghdad was still impressive, but from an intellectual point of view, a shadow of its former self. In contrast, Cairo was a rising star. In 969, a Fatimid general conquered Fustat, the capital of the province of Egypt, and built a new city alongside it called Al-Qahira, from which we get Cairo. Like Baghdad, Cairo started out as a royal city, dominated by palaces and residential areas for ministers and soldiers. It also contained the Azhar Mosque, which is still the foremost mosque of Cairo today. The Fatimids were a Shi'i dynasty, keen to promote their religious ideas, which drew inspiration from Greek philosophy as well as from the Islamic tradition. They were therefore as committed to education as the Abbasids had been in earlier centuries. Their palace housed a magnificent library and study centre, said to have had 40 halls stocked with over 2 million volumes, of which 18,000 were translations of Greek classics. This was their house of knowledge. Although we can assume some exaggeration, the Fatimid collection must still have been of staggering size. In Baghdad and in Cairo, learning flourished best during times of wealth and political stability. Baghdad's eclipse coincided with political upheavals and economic problems in Iraq. And as the Fatimid Caliphate weakened, so did Cairo's role as a seat of learning. Saladin not only defeated Richard the Lionheart, he also closed the Fatimid House of Knowledge. However, the knowledge that had been generated over the centuries did not die. It was carried on to other cities and even to other worlds, including the Muslim-Christian frontier in Spain, where more translation took place, this time from Arabic into Hebrew and Latin, thus introducing Latin Christendom to the intellectual fruits of Baghdad and Cairo, two of Islam's greatest cities of learning.